buddy ordered it. He bought his own panels and then brought in an electrician to do the electrical work. He did much of the physical install on the roof himself. So, you know, at that point, he just had to pay labor for the electrician to do the hookup, the inspection. LIPA did have to inspect it. They did not have to change the meter. Let me drop.
In other words, I think you're telling me your normal meter runs backwards and somehow accumulates. I thought they have to have a separate meter because they pay you at a different rate on what you send back versus what you get. Over to you, Bernie.
When my buddy first went online, he had his old, let's say, mechanical or analog meter, and it just spun backwards. He is a very fastidious kind of guy who was keeping extremely accurate records, reading his meter every morning. And after a while, LIPA switched him over to a digital meter, to which he actually proved was inaccurate, and then they put in a second digital meter. But they can run the analog meters and run them backwards. He thinks that he probably just annoyed him into replacing with a digital meter that could be a little more accurate. But there's, you know, it's one of those things that the hidden costs are what you need to be aware of. Those are the things you brought up. One thing that we haven't discussed is the cost of your roof. There's roof loading on this. And this is where, according to my buddy, he said that as long as you only have one roof on your house, then you can put these things on top of it. But many people, when they re-roof, they just re-roof on top of the old roof. They have two roofs. I don't remember how many roofs you're allowed to have here before you have to strip it, but that becomes an issue. Also, when you put the panels on top, you don't want to have to change your shingles underneath, so you have to disassemble the whole thing. So the roofing cost becomes one of the hidden costs to it.
K2KY.
Yeah, Mel's the next guy on the list. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, as far as the roof goes, yes. And then not only that, it's not a regular shingled roof that you have to put under it. They found that it rusts. You got to put a rubber membrane roof down, some kind of a special material. That's going to cost you to do that roof. I think the guy said on my roof would be between about $7,500, $8,000 to put that kind of roof down. Got to pull up all the shingles. And he says a good chance after they pull up all the shingles that the original roofing, the wood roofing, the decking, which was not plywood in those days, of course, it was just, you know, clapboard boards, he says would most likely have to be pulled up and re-sheathed. So you're looking at $10,000. Now, that's, do that if you went that. Now I says, well, how about a do-it-yourself job? I says, the heck with all this. I checked insurance. Now, let's face it, you got to get insurance. Who knows? A hurricane can come in and rip this whole thing up, and these things go flying off and onto other people's property, and God knows what could happen. But you never know with, you know, a big wind coming once in a while. And do-it-yourself job, insurance company won't even talk to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's if they know you've done it yourself. If the installation is there and it gets properly inspected, so they have to know who did it as long as it meets code. Back to you for a quick one on that one, Mel.
Now, I've had my fun with the buildings department, with this tower. I almost gave up. First of all, you know, original application was for a 100-foot tower. That they cut down right away. I had to forget it, and I finally got an agreement on an 85-foot tower. Then it was a specification on the concrete. So I went ahead and I put down 2,000 pounds of concrete. Guy came, the inspector, and he says, who poured the concrete? I says, I did. He says, well, he says, you know, I says, this is an amateur radio project. That means do it yourself. That's part of amateur radio. You see, everything is done properly. I says, do you think I bought 20 bags, 100-pound bags I had delivered of concrete, and I have them hidden somewhere? I says, look at the pad down here. I says, you don't think it's poured at this point? And he was ready, and he begrudgingly gave me a permit for it. And it came to insurance now. Ha, ha, ha. They have no category and all, and I had to take out, I have a separate insurance policy called a add-on or whatever the hell they are. For the tower, which I got a hard time getting that thick. If I ever had to do it all over again, what I went through, I guess I would just pass up on it. Over.
And I live in Suffolk County, and it only took me 5.5 years to get a permit for my tower. But that's another whole story. I forget who's on the list next. Who thinks they're on the list next?
I do.
Go ahead, John. Yes, we haven't heard from you for a while. Go ahead, John.
Dick, as far as all of this with the solar power, think of it this way. The most restrictive requirement is to disconnect an auto transfer switch set up from Edison to make sure Edison is disconnected when you have a generator running. So if you were to put all of this in for a generator, which they can't deny you, emergency generator, you can just go ahead, set it up like it would be a generator, and put a transfer switch in and put up your solar cells. Now the only thing is, it's true, Edison meters will run backwards, and it will work. But for the average guy, maybe you don't even want to do that. Just the fact that you're not going to be using Edison, or you'll be supplanting their energy with your own, that's a benefit in itself. So that's an easier way to look at it. And that's really the most restrictive part with Edison or any of the utilities.
By the way, changing the meter is free.
Give us just some more words on that one, Bernie. And give us a little bit more audio if you can, Bernie.
Okay, sorry about that. It's been a long day. I'm kind of beat down for the day. You don't own your electric meter, so to change it is free. If I call LIPA and say the magic smoke came out of my electric meter, they'll send somebody out here immediately to replace it because that belongs to them. The pan that it sits in, they own. That box and socket that it fits in, the socket that it fits in, I own, but the physical meter, they own. So let's say I did go online with generating my own electricity, they have to accept it by law, so therefore they're going to change the meter, and it's not going to cost me a dime.
The price is right. Who's next? I am. You got it, Eric. All right, going along with what Glenn said, he's got it down to $2.30 a watt, and the cheapest I've found it online is $2.60 a watt. So you're taking up a lot of real estate, but there are inverters that include a transfer tie-off, and also code. There's an inverter called Sunny Boy, and it'll cost you, if you buy an 8-kilowatt inverter, it'll cost you about $3,200. You can maybe find it a little cheaper. You don't have to have, 10 1,000-watt inverters. Sunny Boy's been in the business for a long time. German company. And I've seen a lot of them around. They work very, very well. So, yeah, you can do that kind of stuff. And you've got to have a lot of roof to do 10 kilowatts because it's a heck of a lot of panels. You figure each panel, the panels are getting more efficient. It used to be the biggest one you could get was like 175 watts. Now you can get 230 watts. I think it was last year I was pricing it out, the 200-watt panels were like $900. Now the 230-watt panels are down to $600. So it's becoming more affordable. But the big thing why the Germans are only paying like $300 a panel that they manufacture is that in this country, the raw materials manufacturers would much rather sell it to the semiconductor industry than to make panels because they get higher prices for making chips.
Almost every KC2 FFA.
FFA recognized. Almost every springtime for the last 3, 4, 5 years, there is a conference held at the agricultural school, as it used to be called, in Farmingdale, whatever it's called, you know the school I'm talking about, on the subject of solar voltaic, or let's call it solar energy conversion systems. And I haven't had a chance to attend one of those, but those friends of mine who have attended it, they're led to believe that it's a relatively easy thing to do, worth considering at this time. I'd like to believe another one of those conferences is coming up in which more of the specific information is going to be given. Wesley's going to make a comment, and then FFA in that order.
One more thing, Dick.
Go ahead, Derek.
If you remember the guy, Olszewski, you saw him on an over about hydrogen. He was the guy who made the hydrogen storage bottle that made of metal hydride. his company manufactures rolls of shingles that are solar voltaic. They're not as efficient as the anamorphic solar voltaics, but you can do your entire house with his shingle and come up with a lot of energy. It's a little bit more expensive. He actually manufactures it on these long beds. His wife died, I think, last year, so he's getting to be an old guy, but his product is beginning to take off, and it's getting cheaper and cheaper, so you don't have to worry about hurricanes and stuff like that. It's just that you need more of it to make the same amount of energy.
That's a nice passive system, which all it does is just lay there and make voltage, and nothing has to move. I kind of like that one.
You can drive nails into it, too.
Boy, that's nice. N2XJN, K2RIW.
N2XJN. I would like to hear from John about his experimenting with listening to the signals. So these signals were heard. If the Haiti signals were heard, then these signals could be heard. But I have another set of questions in regards to the high-quality pictures that I have sent you. Very much an unusual way of connecting Redbridge and being able to light the light bulb. 500 watts, 230 volts on the one single piece of wire. That experiment was done by me, by Mr. Jacek from Poland, on exactly the same element, and on another gentleman for the distance of 100 feet or even more, and John was able to view that. So I would like to give the microphone with your permission to John.
Go ahead, John. Let me pick up Charles, who just signed in, and then we'll go back to these other questions. KC2FFA, K2RIW. My name is Dick. Go ahead, Charles.
Thank you, Dick. I just have a query for the net. Hopefully somebody can help me out. The other day, all of a sudden, I see a brand new electrical box and an antenna on the pole at the corner of my block. It came out of nowhere. It's called NextG. And I think it's for mobile phones and stuff. And I've never seen it before on any of the poles all around the neighborhood driving around. And it just appeared out of magic. I wonder if anybody knows anything about it. I did read it with binoculars on it. It does say RF exposure, has a NY, I think, D number, a telephone number. I looked up, I Googled the telephone number, didn't find nothing. I noticed it's unrelated to your topic, so I was just curious if anybody has any idea what this is. Over to you, Dick. KC2FFA.
It's a microcell.
Yeah, that was my first guess. Go ahead and give us some words on that one, Eric. And how many of them do you think are being placed in what towns on Long Island?
Well, if you guys had watched the news about, I think about 5 or 6 weeks ago, the folks in Garden City were really upset that all of a sudden one day they started seeing these antennas and boxes on the poles. And they're in the process of trying to sue them, but they're not going to get very far because the utilities have the right-of-way, and it's their poles, and they can do, in essence, what they want. But they're basically low-power cell sites. And it's for no good reason. I think they're only they're less than a watt apiece, but the I think it's Nextel, AT&T, no, not AT&T, and Verizon, they're trying to fill the holes in their system. Whereas because the towns have so many restrictions, they can't have the big cell sites everywhere. So they're trying to fill in the blank spaces.
WS2N.
Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, Channel 12 had a good story about it, and I believe it was in Newsday, too, about a guy out in Suffolk. They put it right on his front lawn, right on the corner. he went nuts. One day he woke up and his thing magically appeared. So they fought that for quite a few weeks. They did make them take it down. There was some kind of a issue with the town. You know, one group is saying it's okay, another one is saying it's not. Went back and forth, and that particular guy got to take it down. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, it turns out that to get good cell phone coverage requires a significant set of cell sites. Lots and lots of people don't know that. I was at a meeting of about 100 people yesterday. Ran into a guy who runs a major educational institution in Queens. He's the manager of this educational institution. And he whipped out his 3G or 4G iPhone, a 3G iPhone, and he's bragging about, look at all the things it can do. And he's flipping the screens and doing all kinds of things. And I said, do you realize what infrastructure is required to maintain that thing in your hand? He says, what do you mean? It's all right here. I said, do you know what is behind that panel, so to speak, electronically speaking? All the very elaborate electronics and the interconnection of the electronics of all of those cell sites in order for you to be able to do that? He wouldn't accept that. He just kept saying, no, it's in my hand. That's what I just purchased. Well, my goodness, we've got a long way to go. Who's next? KQRIW.
Oh, by the way, the other reason for the Microsoft sites is 4G. Is that you don't get very far to have it work because of the bandwidth you need. And the other thing with the iPhone, you don't realize it, but you're using four separate bands to do that.
John's call phonetically.
So the four separate bands you're talking about, give us some more words on that one, Eric. And I know that they're trying to build out right now for the 4G, but I'm guessing they're getting some mixed results. KE2EJ, KQRIW.
John's call is KC2
West.
John's call.
All right. The 4G, you know, Verizon's LTE and a few others are really a bit of a farce because they don't have the infrastructure. The placement of cell sites have to be much closer together because signal noise is such a problem with the bigger bandwidth. Whereas the phones are delivering are capable. But most of the time, if you actually do a speed test on your 4G or your LTE, you find out you're really running 3G. And the reason why there are four separate bands is still the analog is mandatory. The digital on the iPhone is at 800. The 3G is in two separate bands. One's at 1200. The other one, I forget what the other one is. I think the other one's just above the ITFS, which I think is about 1400. So what they call the edges on the 1200 and the full 3G is in the 1400, and as you travel around the country, you'll find that your speeds jump up and down.
Do you own a 4G-capable phone? And if so, how many places can you go and get 4G service? Eric, go ahead.
I personally only have an iPhone, so that's 3G. But a couple of my buddies who really got into it started running speed tests on their 4Gs. And they live in the city where there's the highest density, and they usually say it's like a 1 in 4 chance that they actually get a 4G connection.
KB2H City with a comment.
Go ahead, Tom.
All right, I also have the iPhone right now from AT&T. And for me, it works very well. If I get on 3G, it works well. And most of the times, I can actually use Wi-Fi. It does work excellent with Echo Link and what have you. And also, you know, as a phone and what such. But I do have it, and it's kind of amazing. I don't have problems over here. But then again, where I am, there's actually cell sites. Over.
Very exciting comment.
So you're a lucky guy that's got local cell sites. Your nearest cell site is how far away from you, Tom?
There's actually one on top of my building, believe it or not.
That's as close as you can get.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. It's kind of amazing. I could actually link it in right now and talk to you guys like nothing. The audio is really amazing. Also, with Droid phones, it works well. I know a lot of people with the Droid,
and the application is the same as far as Echolink and what have you. It's kind of amazing. But for me, it does work well. Some people do have problems with it.
It's very...
The 3G saturation in and around the city, Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Manhattan, is really good. AT&T did a very good build-out. You go away from the city, then it starts to become a problem. Going to Suffolk County, you'll find yourself using Edge instead of 3G a lot.
Glad to hear that, Eric. Bernie, go ahead.
Shoot, I'm sorry. I forgot what I was going to say. I'm getting too tired here. I'm sorry, Dick. Back to you.
John's calling for now.
You'll soon think of it.
Dick?
Go ahead. You thought of it, Eric. I mean that, Bernie.
John's Connecticut. Casey? Gay voice. John's calling.
Go ahead, Bernie. Just talk on top.
John's calling for Connecticut.
Hang on a second, Dick.
Please, gay boyfriend.
Okay, back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I thought you called me again because you thought of what you had forgotten.
I understand. Back to you, Dick.
Okay.
Glenn, I forgot about the Messenger spacecraft.
Go right ahead. Yeah. Messenger is now in orbit. Give us some words on that one, Paul.
Completely forgot about that. Yeah, that was on the 17th. I know I've been talking about it for years. 6.5 years ago, I think, was launch. It took that long. I think about 12 or 14 revolutions around the sun, at least. Maybe more. I forgot the number. But whatever. After 6.5 years, it slowed itself down after passing Earth and passing Venus and passing Mercury, I don't know how many times, 3 or 4 times, eventually deaccelerating, going into 120 by, I think, something like probably 10,000 mile orbit. I mean, very elongated right now. 120 is the lowest point, but it takes 12 hours to orbit the planet. Sending excellent pictures back. Everything's working. All the scientists are all going to be thrilled because now their mission starts. The engineering part is over. But I'll stay into orbit for many, many years to come. We've now orbited, I believe, 5 different planets besides the Moon and the Earth. And that's doing pretty good. You know, we've done Mercury.
John's call phonetically is Casey to Wesley's gay boyfriend.
Mercury, of course, Earth. We've orbited Venus many times. Magellan, Venus Express. We've landed there with spacecraft. Mars has been covered, of course. Jupiter. And Saturn, we're doing pretty good. All we got to do now is orbit Uranus and Neptune, and we'll be in good shape. But that spacecraft Messenger is 100% thick back here.
Have you seen any of the pictures? And I think we've sent a spacecraft to Pluto. Do you have a guess as to when that one arrives? Back to you, Paul.
I did see one picture on the NASA site, the first picture that they sent back of Mercury. Very interesting. And then naturally they have the details on it. You've got a 800 degree range between the sun side and the dark side. Possibility of ice in some of the craters. On the North and South Poles. Messenger will investigate that. Most likely confirm that one way or the other. I remember you brought that up a couple of weeks ago.
And the one going to Pluto is the New Horizon mission. Was I believe that's 2015. So we got what, 3-4 years left before that thing gets out there. Now that will not orbit Pluto. That's just going to bypass the planet, or no longer a planet. It was a planet when it left here, and now it's been demoted to a planetesimal with two moons. And then after that, it will go out into deeper space and investigate the Kepler belt. Kuiper belt, as some people pronounce it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm a little disappointed that we're only going to get a flyby of Pluto and not a orbit. And that's probably one of these almost grand tour-like things. In other words, it's making a number of gravity assist flyby of a number of planets to get out to Pluto. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to get out there. And I guess there's not enough left over to do a deorbit burn and put yourself into orbit around Pluto. So, was New Horizons always planned that way, Paul, or was there a time when the project was a little more funded and there was the ability to get into orbit around Pluto? Over to you, Paul.
John's call
was funded out. They never had plans on orbiting. Originally it was going to be called the Kepler, believe it or not. They changed the name as time went on to a New Horizons because they had dropped the program and then they brought it back. So it's got things to investigate. It's got it'll slow down quite a bit. It's going to send back probably thousands of pictures as it approaches and as it leaves. They wanted to do it now because this is the time when Pluto is closest to the Earth. It's going to go into a real deep freeze, in the future. So this is probably the one time that they get a good chance to see what it's like for the next couple of hundred years. It won't be in this configuration. So they did want to rush on it and get it out there. They funded it, and it went. But they, it will go out into the Kuiper belt and investigate other things after that, things that we don't know about. So I think that, it's a multi-task spacecraft. Back to you.
The Voyager spacecraft, I think, have almost gone beyond nearly twice the distance to Pluto. Pluto is 39 astronomical units. So has Voyager, which was launched in the 70s, I think it is still operational, Voyager 1 or 2, and I believe it's almost twice the distance to Pluto. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, 39 AU for Pluto. This thing's out around 80. So I think it's something like 11 billion miles out, both of them. And one is on the ecliptic, and the other one is probably about 30 degrees north of the ecliptic. And Voyager 1 is that one, that's 30 degrees north, looking down. And that's the one that's there. They've just last week changed its orientation so that the detector that picks up the solar wind could figure out where the solar wind is coming from. It's from its position in space, it looks like the solar wind has stopped. And that's what they always wanted to find. Where is the heliosphere? Where does the solar system end? Where does the solar wind meet the interstellar wind? And it's gotten to that point. So by reorienting itself and checking which direction the solar wind is coming from now, they can tell that, it's bouncing off this heliosphere and coming back in another direction. And by figuring out all this stuff out over time, a lot of measurements, they could actually triangulate more or less where it's how far out, how much further is the heliosphere. So they call this the heliosheath of what it's hitting now. So the heliosphere is a little past that. And Voyager 2 is doing the same thing, both alive and well.
A recommendation, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Please advise everybody not to pick up so quick. I need a little more time between transmissions, please.
Oh, fuck it, Eddie.
Okay, we can do that. I think we did pass it over to you earlier, so go ahead and pick up, John.
Hey, you fucking idiot.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, back to you. Just my recommendation.
John's call phonetically is gay boyfriend.
You're getting some input signal in Staten Island, is that true, John?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Dick, I could really use a phone call from you, but I know you're in the middle of this right now. I should have spoken to you earlier.
Understand. Okay. Who else has anything else that we think we should be discussing at this time? Give me your call letters. K2RIW.
WS1, one quick question, I think.
Go ahead, Paul.
In regard to a Kier tying it into an HF rig, the HF rig has a Kier inside, so what you would have is a paddle on the exterior. How important do you think it is to use shielded wire? Trying to come up with, it needs three wires. It needs a dot and a dash, and it needs a shield. That's what it shows on the, when you read the manual. But I'm not seeing any, I got the plug. I've already did one plug. I did one plug for the straight key. Now I want to do one for the paddles. Straight key was easier because all I needed was two wires. I had shielded wire for that. And just needed two, to operate that. But the paddle needs three. You don't know, I bet Mel does. But I want to, how important it really is to use shielded, because I have wires, cables that I have, have three wires and a cable where I could do it, but it's not shielded wire. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to make a guess on this one, and then I'm going to pass it over to Mel. If the leads are twisted together, I think there's a medium good chance you'll get away with it. The Cadillac approach is, yes, shielded wire. But if they're twisted together, I think there's a medium chance the rig will not give you any peculiar characteristics. Wonder what you think, Mel, and what have your guys the Kings County Radio Club, what have they done? K2KEY, K2RIW.
I questioned that also at one time because it's a nice wire that was not shielded. It's, nice flexible three-wire that I said, gee, maybe I used this. But when I read the manual on this high-end rig I have here, one of the high-end ones, they all seem to say the same thing. Shielded wire required. Maybe it's feedback from people that, complained of a certain problem with the internal gear in the rig, some kind of a problem developing, that they actually show it to you, drawn with shielded wire, Dick. So I figured, the heck with it, I'll put the shielded wire ready. It's just as easy if you happen to have the material. But I never experimented with, just like you say, regular wire, that like three wire, you know, encased three wire, just insulated over.
WB2HWW with a comment.
You have the wire. I you know, it's one of these little plugs, these 3.5 millimeter plugs. This isn't for my rig. This is for another rig. You know, mine's fine the way it is, but I wonder if you had the wire. You know, it's not like the big plugs. Like my Kenwood 440 has a big plug. No problem. I can get any kind of wire for that, shielded wire. But this is real teeny tiny. You got to solder these little connections on one of those small plugs.
WB2HWW.
Yeah, I wonder if you've got experience with this, Howie, and what have you found?
Experience with that, but I want to make a comment. A lot of people don't realize this. If you really shouldn't use the shield at the ground return, you should have three wires and a shield. And from what I've done from working in engineering, is you always leave one end of the shield open. Whichever is the sending end, whichever is the receiving end, you leave the shield not connected on one end. If you use the shield to drain off the RF, you don't want to use the shield as the return. Go ahead, Dick.
Well, in his case, if he was going from between two chassis, I think you'd want to use the shield on both ends. If you're going within a single chassis, I agree with you. You might want to leave the shield on one end open. But he's going from, in theory, a shielded chassis over to a thoroughly external paddle. And there may be a grounded lead on the base of the paddle that he could connect to the shield. And, of course, there's a grounded lead where he could connect the shield at the radio end. So in that case, I would be tempted to use the shield on both ends. Howie, I wonder how you feel on that one. You'd rather float it at one end so that the base of the paddle was not connected to anything? Over to you, Howie.
Won't work. Dick, you can't. It's part of the operation. You got a dot and a dash, and they're using a common shield, you know, for return.
Still using a common, using a third wire to common, but the shield gets tied to the ground. Dick, whenever you're working with, let's say, multiplexes, or you have a sensor out there, sensor or something, this may not be as sensitive, but if you have a sensor out there, where you have a transducer, I would say, you have two wires in the middle and you have the shield. At the sending end, wherever the transducer is, you tie the shield to the ground. At the other end, you leave the shield open. You don't want the shield to be, because then you'll have current flowing down the shield and creating interference. Go ahead, Dick.
KC2, QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, my experience with shields are generally like this. Normally, I want a circuit where all of the communications wires don't require the shield first. So in other words, all of the connections going back and forth are operating properly, so that whatever's connected on one side is connected on the other side electrically first. Then if there's a chassis on a piece of equipment, then cover the shield over the outside of the cable that's not making any of the signal connections going back and forth, and basically just connect the shield to the chassis. But I would do it on both ends, because as long as the circuit is operating without the shield and the electrical connection is already being maintained, then there's no current in the shield itself, and this way you get the best possible shielding from the shield, knowing that your electrical circuit's running on the inside and the shield on the outside is just a no current flow kind of a situation. Back over to you, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
In the case of a shielded lead inside of a chassis where there is a local magnetic field, like, say, for instance, from a transformer, you might want to ground that shield only on one side, because if you don't, you're going to complete a circuit with the shield and the magnetic field that's local. You've now got current flowing in that shield, and that current flowing in the shield might destroy the signals. I think in some cases you've got to experiment which way works the best. But I can see what Howie is saying. I think there are circumstances where you come out with better isolation with the shield only connected on one side. There are other times when the shield should be connected on both sides. So I think an experiment is required. But to answer your original question, Paul, there is the possibility that RF energy is going to be coupled back into your rig and do some funny things, even when you're not in the CW mode because of that unshielded paddle. I think you're a man of enough resources where you can go out and buy shielded wiring for that paddle. Over to you, Paul, for a comment on that. WS2N, K2RIW. Okay, we're going to go to Paul and then Mel in that order. Go ahead, Paul.
Bob. What? Yeah, I wanted to use this plug, just, you know, thought of my own on, but to find a shielded cable with two Y's in it, you know, Yazer writes this up. This is for the new rig, by the way, the 450D, and that's the way they showed it. They showed it the paddle, you know, the paddle, and the paddle has three Y's, you know, dot, dash, and in the center is the shield. And they want you to wire that, and they show you the pin, you know, the plug taking it apart, where they go. You know, dot in the front, dash, and then the back end of the shield. And that's what they want, so. I guess that's what they're going to get somehow. But I wanted to find out. You already answered my question. It looks like you should have the shield. I think I heard Melanie again. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, you've got it, Mel.
Exactly, the cable that you're looking for, the mini cable, that microphone cable, Paul, they use it for a push-to-talk mic. It's a very thin cable for that small plug. The paddles, some of the paddles, the commercial paddles, they sell it and they give you a few feet of wire. Or they tell you if you want to specify which plug you want on it or whatever. You know what I'll tell it to you, all made up. They all use shielded wire. That's a fact, Paul. So you must ground, it must ground to the case, to the metal casing or the bed of the paddle. And then the other two leads, of course, go to the dip and the dot. And that's the way it is set up. They all show that in the instruction manual for the wiring of the of a paddle to the rig. That's the way they specify it. So stay with that, Dick, Paul, because there may be some reasons that they found out through feedback. Over.
Okay, I'll do that. Yeah, with the push to talk mic wire. Okay, I'll locate that. I'd rather thought of my own. I know my side of things, it's not coming apart. I bought plugs and wires pre-made, you know, and then you move them around, and next thing you know, a couple of months later, you have these intermittent problems. I've seen it even on speaker connections. The wire is so fine, it just deteriorates over time. I'm sure you've come across that. But I know when I solder it on, it's good forever. You know, that's what I'd rather do. So, there you go. Dick?
Yeah, I do recommend you take the conservative approach, Paul. It's a fairly small detail, but it could give you quite a bit of grief. It's not worth the gamble. Unless you were on a desert island and that's all you had. But you're not that desperate, and you're a man of resources. Alrighty, who else thinks we should be discussing any of the above subjects? Give me your call letters right now.
And through, shit.
John's call.
Go right ahead, Wesley.
Gay boyfriend.
I want to make sure that John is available. John?
Yes, I am, Wes.
Okay, I have made the experiment, it was quite a time ago. The same experiment was conducted in Poland, and the same experiment was conducted in Russia, and also John was able to review that experiment. You have a generator which generates somewhere 200 hertz. You can go even higher with that. And then from the flyback transformer from the secondary that is connected to the generator, you have about 4,000 volts. Now, you have only one wire from the secondary connected, the other one is not connected at all. Although, you don't have to use the transformer, you can use just a piece of ferrite and wind the windings by yourself. Two winds on the primary and or three winds on the primary and whatever that will give you 4,000 volts on the secondary. Let me drop.
What an idiot!
Okay, now, the only one wire goes from the secondary and it is connected to the grid bridge, and you have a series of photographs. Glenn does have it as well. They're high quality photographs showing how the grid bridge looks like that I have made. And from the AC you have two contacts, and from DC you have two contacts. The only one side of the AC is connected, the other one is never connected. Now, from the DC side of the grid bridge,
the stupid idiot,
you have a capacitor connected, approximately. I have two capacitors on the picture in series, 1 microfarad each one, non-polarized. Now, across this capacitor from the DC, there are two wires, and these two wires are connected to 500 watts halogen light bulb, and this light bulb is 230. Now, in the middle of that light bulb, I have winded a stainless steel wire without the insulation. Now, with that strange connection, the light bulb was giving me the light. It wasn't very bright, but it did. Now, the guy in Poland was able to make a full brightness of this light bulb, but it wasn't this one, it was the second one. He had two light bulbs connected. Now, there was another experiment that was across over 100 feet.
Stupid idiot!
And also, one wire was going from sort of transmitter, and from the other side, there was the motor connected, the DC motor connected, and I would like John to explain how it was, how the counterpoises were connected, because this is nothing else but the Tesla wireless or one-wire concept. John, pick up.
John's call phonetically is Casey.
Now, this, I do remember seeing this email from you, which was labeled Modeling and Adam, but it really says Experiment by Wesley and Jacek, J-A-C-E-K. And I saw the 500-watt halogen lamp, but it's not the filament of the 500-watt halogen lamp that's lighting. It is a kind of an electronic discharge where you're lighting the gas that's inside of the halogen lamp. That was my first impression. Over to you on that one, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW on the TechNet.
This call is phonetic. Wesley's gay boyfriend.
KC2WGV. Dick, if you look at that diagram, Wesley explained to you how he takes the flyback and sends it into the bridge, and you've got a capacitor there, and lighting bulbs. But if you notice, one of those bulbs look like a xenon flash tube from a camera. I do not think that's an incandescent bulb. The long tube, approximately 120 millimeters, that looks like a type of quartz lamp. And I believe you're right. I don't see any filament brightness. When he goes near that, it looks like a glow. The other bulb is lit, but I don't think that's a filament bulb. I wanted to see what you thought about it when you looked at it.
Yeah, but can you explain, maybe it would be helpful if you explained that experiment with the 100 feet distance and the electric motor. John?
Yes, I will. Okay, the electric motor. What he has a device that they call the catcher device. This is the transmitter end. From this device, he has a wire that runs about 100 feet to a beer keg sitting on a plastic chair on top of what looks like a clam pot where they boil clams in. He also has an ignition coil. The wire goes that's an auto transformer, of course, into the top of it where the spark distributor would go into. That's where his transmission wire goes into. He comes out of the secondary part of that auto transformer, the lower two terminals, and he was running an electric motor on that from this device. That's what Wesley was trying to describe.
Yeah, I just want to add that from that, there was connected to the rectifier exactly the same way that I did. And the beer can was serving as a counterpoise. And there was nowhere connection. Now, the transmitter could be connected from the power, but it could be connected from 9-volt battery. It doesn't matter, it's going to work. And, John, approximately, how you, what strong was that motor? What do you think?
I would say that motor was probably like a 60th horsepower motor. A little DC motor, approximately 2 inches in diameter, maybe 3 inches long, something like that. And you could see it had healthy RPMs. The speed I don't know, but you can see the disc he has on it is spinning quite quickly. Also, Wesley is questioning, how does the motor operate? What is the return pad? I think the return pad is either stray capacitance or some type of inductance. We can't send current out without having it come back, and that's what he was questioning. Do you think those beer cans, the beer kegs, are set up and it's capacitively coupled back to the earth? That's what he was questioning.
You have a copy of that video, Dick?
Yeah, I think you're talking about the one that's labeled repeaters and so and etc. And internally it says, sending electricity using one wire only. Is that the one, the YouTube video you're talking about?
That is correct. Should sell the backyard and the beer can at the beginning you have a small device, which is nothing like, that's what I described, a high voltage source and one wire going out. Now this, whether it's connected to the ground, to the grid, or it's connected to 9-volt battery, it works as well. And this is basically a Tesla concept. I believe nothing has to be proven, only question, Tesla did it before.
I think this is the one where the beer keg is sitting on the chair in the backyard, and the beer keg has the brand name of ZIPFER, is that the one?
It is.
I think he's also holding on to a hexagonal key, and he's touching the beer keg with the hexagonal key. Is that the one?
Yes, he's trying to say that even though that he can touch with his own hand the beer can. He will not get electrocuted, but if you take the key, you're going to see a very, very tiny spark. So he's showing this effect. Now, you see the high voltage coil? You see how the can is connected as a counterpoise? You see also that the wire goes to the grass bridge, exactly the configuration that you have on my pictures. And then you see the motor connected. How do you estimate the power of that motor, Dick?
and the motor itself is turning, but it's turning what looks like a plastic disc. It doesn't look like it's producing any significant amount of power. Is that true?
Are you happy that
Mark,
well, you're not.
He seems to also have a ignition coil from an automobile sitting on the red chair in the backyard. Is that true?
That is true.
Is there enough information for us to figure out the schematic diagram of how all of that stuff is hooked up?
Yes. A 9-volt battery going to the signal generator, the square wave signal, approximately somewhere in the vicinity of 500 hertz, but could be more, could be 1 kilohertz. Then this is connected to the high voltage transformer, which could be flyback or just a thyroid with the windings on it. The 4,000 volts, 3,500, 4,000 volts, with one wire only, the other one is not connected, goes to that long wire. 100 feet later, you have a high voltage coil that this wire is connected. Actually, it's the oil transformer, right? And then the other side of it is connected to the grid bridge, the way that you have on the pictures. And then you have a motor connected.
So one possibility is that the 100-foot long wire goes to the secondary winding of the coil. The other end of the coil is going to the keg, and that's acting as a local capacitor. Voltage is being induced across that spark coil. The primary winding goes to the rectifier. The rectifier produces DC voltage that runs the motor, and it turns that plastic wheel. That's what I think I'm seeing. And so, yes, he's transmitting power over one wire. The keg is acting as a local ground, and the coil is in between, and the secondary of the coil is picking up the, let me pick a number, 80 KC, or the flyback voltage. So, although it looks like one wire, there really is a ground return by way of the keg sitting there as a large capacitor to ground, and the coil in between that wire and that keg. That's a guess on my part. Let's see if you see it that way, and see if John sees it that way. Over to you, Wesley.
Yeah, if you relate it to the ground plane and the role that the counterpoise, the 4.5 feet by 4.5 feet plate of the metal is playing on it. Can you see any relation to that?
The 4.5 feet by 4.5 feet, is that the metal that's inside the house, or are you talking about the cake?
No, I'm talking about typical grand plane antenna on the roof.
The size of a ground plane antenna on the roof, how big a ground plane is primarily a function of what is the frequency the antenna is acting at. It's nice to have a quarter wavelength in all directions from the center of the ground plane. It'd be nice to have that. If you have less than that, you have an amount of stray reactants, which it's possible to redesign the antenna to operate with a smaller ground plane. You'll end up with a hot piece of coax cable if you don't have the right kind of a balancing device, but it's possible to have a quarter-wave ground plane antenna with an undersized counterpoise and still get reasonable transmitting efficiency. Maybe that's what you're asking. K2RAW, over to you, Wesley.
OHWW, what a comment.
Acting as a counterpoise.
Comment.
Go ahead, Howie.
Sounds like the ground is your return, and the keg is acting as a capacitor. So you have a series capacitor, so the capacitor is giving you some impedance, some reactance, and that's why you have the rectifier on the other end. You're running enough of a voltage, a high enough voltage, so that you can come back to the earth. That's what it sounds like.